20 years ago, two men brutally beat and tortured Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old gay college student in Laramie, Wyoming. Shepard died 6 days later, on October 12, 1998.
He had been tied to a fence, pistol whipped, and left to die. Two suspects will be charged with the murder. President Clinton today condemned the attack and said Congress should pass hate crime legislation.
But it took until 2009 for President Barack Obama to sign the Matthew Shepard Act, which updated the federal hate crimes law to include crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability.
Time and again, we faced opposition. Time and again, the measure was defeated or delayed. Time and again, we've been reminded of the difficulty of building a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit.
But a law on the books doesn't mean people are actually protected. Some states still haven't expanded their own hate crime language, and people in the transgender community say they feel especially vulnerable.
People don't understand us. People have been fired, people have been hurt, people have been jumped and killed just for being out as transgender or being found out.
20-year-old Armani Gucci is an executive board member of Trans Student Educational Resources.
Bullying and harassment is kind of at the forefront of a lot of our issues.
And for trans women of color like Armani, the bullying and harassment can be particularly severe.
Personally, people have shouted at me just walking down the street as people are driving by. They yell it out of their cars. They call names. A really close personal friend of mine, it was probably the worst experience that they had being a trans person of color, but they were literally pushed back and forth as if it were a game of monkey in the middle in the hallways at school, and it resulted in a back injury. It was that bad, and people have spit in her hair.
As transgender Americans gain more visibility, they also face increasing discrimination, harassment, and violence. Over the last 5 years, violence against this community has been on the rise, and 2018 is shaping up to be among the deadliest on record. So far, at least 22 transgender women have been murdered, most of them women of color, according to the Human Rights Campaign. But that estimate only tells us part of the story. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today, National Coming Out Day, on The Takeaway. This year, transgender people have been killed in cities across the country, from Jacksonville, Florida, to Cleveland, Ohio, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Portland, Oregon. Just at the beginning of the month, Ciara Minaj Carter Frazier, a Black trans woman, was stabbed to death in Chicago. Part of the problem is that transgender deaths are often underreported and misreported. And in a few minutes, we'll speak with a ProPublica reporter about the challenges police face when investigating these crimes. But first, a look at the broader picture of these attacks. Sarah McBride is a transgender activist and the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your organization has been tracking these murders. Are you seeing a rise in attacks year over year, or could this be a case of just more attention to the issue?
Well, I think that that's a fantastic question. I think there's probably both factors at play here. There's no question that we are seeing an increase in law enforcement and media accurately reporting on hate and violence that already existed throughout this country against the transgender community. But the reality is that across the board, we are seeing an increase in hate-based violence against marginalized Americans from all backgrounds, including transgender people. And there's no question that the toxic political climate we see, the vicious rhetoric we see from many politicians at the state and federal level, the increased attention in many ways has put a spotlight on the transgender community and put many, many members of our community at danger of discrimination, harassment, and of course, fatal violence.
And we're hearing a lot, Sarah, about specifically about transgender women of color. Are they being targeted for any specific reason? Is there something that's leading to violence against that community within the transgender community specifically?
Well, every single year that we have been tracking violence against the transgender community, the vast majority of victims of this violence have been transgender women of color, and in particular, Black transgender women. And that is a byproduct of the fact that when transphobia is mixed with misogyny and racism, it can have often deadly consequences. The more prejudices a person has to interact with on any given day compounds the discrimination, compounds the barriers that are put in their way. And that when you combine these prejudices, the toxic combination of these prejudices, it can embolden and inflame existing violence. It can embolden and inflame the attacks that are coming transgender people's way. And that's one of the main reasons why we see transgender women of color so disproportionately overrepresented in the number of victims that die each year.
Sarah, how much does income and demographics outside of race have to do with this? We know that 29% of transgender respondents to the 2015 U.S. Trans Survey said they were living in poverty, 15% were unemployed, and 12% had been homeless.
One of the things we always want to make clear when we're talking about the violence facing the trans community is that in many cases, it's a hate crime. In other cases, it might not technically be deemed a hate crime, but hate is no less a factor or contributor to the violence. Because in many situations, to your point, individuals who are experiencing or facing violence are facing circumstances where violence is more likely due to institutional or systemic barriers to stable employment, to shelter, to access to goods and services that people need to live and thrive. And so when you add in all of these systemic barriers, when you add in class and poverty and economic status, it can oftentimes put people in circumstances where they're more likely to face this kind of violence.
And we mentioned that tomorrow marks 20 years since Matthew Shepard died. The Shepard Byrd Act, which was named after him, gives the Department of Justice the power to investigate and prosecute bias-motivated crimes against LGBTQ victims. Is there more of a need for protection specifically for transgender Americans?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, there are a number of states that still do not have inclusive protections when it comes to hate crimes. But we also need more states and the federal government to pass non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people, and particularly transgender people, because as we've talked about, there are so many factors contributing to this violence. It's not just a matter of passing inclusive hate crimes. It's about making sure we have better data collection for a clear picture. And it's about making sure that transgender people are safe from discrimination that can oftentimes put them in these circumstances.
Sarah McBride is the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How do local police and the criminal justice system deal with murders of transgender people? Lucas Waldron is a reporter at ProPublica who's been keeping track of homicides of trans people and investigations throughout the country.
What happens often during a homicide investigation with a transgender victim is folks will look at someone's ID or how perhaps they are listed on a birth certificate, state-issued ID, and go with kind of the gender marker that is listed on that ID. Normally, it's an M or an F. And so to misgender someone is to essentially call someone by a gender that they don't identify with. So it's someone who identifies as, you know, female, and you are consistently referring to them as he and him and, you know, with male pronouns. This term dead naming comes into play when you're using a name that someone does not use anymore to describe themselves. So trans folks are often, you know, given a name at birth that might match, you know, the gender, the sex that they're assigned at birth. And then later in life, you know, kind of walk away from that name and start living a different, you know, life with a different name. And so when we think about dead naming, it's a term that does not just apply to, you know, murders or homicide cases. It's kind of a term used throughout the transgender community to describe calling someone by a name that they just don't identify with anymore.
And I'm wondering how that impacts the investigations into these crimes that we're looking at.
So the way that we see this play out a lot across the country, and what I found in my reporting with my colleague Ken Schwenke, who's my co-reporter on this project, we've found that police departments are often using state-issued IDs that are often outdated to refer to homicide victims. And, you know, by nature, homicide victims can't advocate for themselves or say how they want to be identified. And so the problems we see with that are a couple different things. First, when you go to the community and you're describing someone by a name and a gender that they no longer identify with, oftentimes their community, their friends, even their family sometimes won't know who you're talking about. And that can be a really big problem in investigations of all kinds, but especially homicide investigations. So when you go into the community and you say, you know, Michael has died, or have you seen Michael recently? And folks are saying, I don't know Michael. You know, this is this friend of mine is someone that I know by a very different name and by, you know, a gender that might not line up with what Michael implies. So we see that as a barrier to investigations kind of all across the country. And we looked at some specific states to get a better understanding of how police were consistently releasing names to the public that just didn't match up with what people knew these people by. So, you know, there are some resources available to police, but one of the things we found over and over again, we looked into 85 different homicides of transgender folks. And in every case we, you know, called, we contacted the police department or the sheriff's office. And what we heard over and over again was not so much that they were, you know, like grappling with this issue or weren't sure what to do. It was just they had absolutely no policy or no plan for how to interact with the transgender community about homicides, but also just more generally speaking. And so that's kind of where we're seeing some police departments start, is trying to kind of create a policy to say, oh, we're not going to, you know, consistently dead name someone, or we're going to try to figure out how someone preferred to be called or identified, both because it's a more respectful way to treat that person, but also because it is actually going to make our investigation easier.
Is there anything that's leading to sort of a culture of impunity when it comes to cases like this?
I think there are a few things. One thing that we heard from trans women, especially trans women in Jacksonville, Florida, where we've seen these three murders of trans women this year that have been unsolved, the women there told us that it felt like there was a culture of impunity because, you know, it didn't feel like there were resources being put into looking into murders of, you know, poor Black trans women. I think we see that, you know, outside of the trans community as well. But folks not really placing a priority on the lives of the, you know, people in our communities that are poor, that don't have access to, you know, the resources that other people have. So I think there's a structural problem with policing in that way. In the cases that we looked at, there was a wide range of different situations. You know, some women were killed in hotels, and in many situations, those cases are unsolved. It's like the police come and they kind of take stock of the scene, and then we don't really hear anything about, you know, ever arrests being made. The investigation is just sort of ongoing forever. In other cases, you know, domestic violence cases where the perpetrator might be much easier to find, there is a little bit more accountability. But, you know, by and large, in most of the cases we looked at, the community, at least, and the folks who knew the women who had been killed felt like there really wasn't any accountability, you know, related to their friend's death.
And you're a reporter who's been covering this extensively, but also as a trans man yourself, do you feel like there are any things that you see that could be done to improve this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As a trans person myself, this was a story that felt really important to me. I've had my own experiences, you know, struggling to get a gender marker change and a name change on my IDs. And, you know, I had issues accessing that even given the fact that I, you know, identify on the masculine side of the spectrum and I'm white and I don't have a lot of the barriers that other folks have. So what I see is that we really do need local police to have more consistent policies about how they approach trans folks or folks that they don't know what their gender identity might be. And I think one of those solutions to that problem is just asking people, asking the community, how did your friend identify? How can we treat them respectfully? You know, what can we do to make sure that we're not consistently calling them by a name that they didn't go by? And I think that's really the first step, is folks just talking to the community more.
Lucas Waldron is a reporter at ProPublica. Lucas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been talking with reporters at the Center for Public Integrity about their series, Abandoned in America, which explores cities and towns across the country where poverty is inescapable. In St. Louis, Missouri, a major component of the crisis is affordable housing. There just isn't enough of it. And for many of the residents who do manage to get a subsidized place to live, conditions only add to the indignity of living and working in poverty.
There was mold inside the apartment. And so what they did was, instead of them getting rid of the mold, they just painted on top of everything. So after about a month or two, the stuff was coming through, you know, through the ceilings, you know, in my basement. I had gone through, oh my gosh, you have no idea what I went through.
That's January Harris, a mother and receptionist in St. Louis. January went from living in an apartment run by the St. Louis Housing Authority to a townhouse run by a private landlord, one that she paid for with help from a federal Section 8 voucher program. But even though she works full-time, January says the assistance she's getting is not enough.
Anybody that is on Section 8 or public housing or some type of housing assistance, they need it. Nobody is using that if they don't need it. They're low-income families. You know, again, they may be disabled. They may not be working. Some people work three part-time jobs. It's not enough. And it's, you know, again, it's still, it's not enough money.
There's a big discrepancy in St. Louis, an economy that President Trump likes to boast is stronger than ever, and a stagnant underclass of people trapped in poverty and challenged every month to keep a roof over their heads. That's what Letitia Beecham, a political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, found in her reporting.
In St. Louis, especially in the city, about 26.7% of the people there are living below the federal poverty level. It's very difficult if you are very low or extremely low income to find affordable housing, and especially if you need assistance. The last time the city opened its Housing Choice Voucher, commonly known as Section 8, was in 2014. So what you have is people waiting years hoping that they'll be able to receive a voucher for housing that will accommodate them and their children. There also are waiting lists for public housing in the city and the county as well.
Now, what are your options if you are waiting for a Section 8 voucher? What do you do in the meantime?
It's not really a pretty picture. People are either in unstable conditions, they're living with family members, some might even be facing homelessness, or they're living in subpar housing conditions as they wait for years to find housing.
I'm curious if you can help us understand how the Section 8 voucher program works. And I know it's a complicated program. There are many different kinds. But what does it generally do?
Yes. So with the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher system, it allows for a person to seek housing through a privately owned property. And the federal government will pay a subsidy to the Section 8 accepting landlord, and the tenant will pay the difference based on their income.
Tell us about January Harris.
January Harris lives out in Ferguson, Missouri. She lives in the county of St. Louis. Within a week of her moving into her townhome for her and her youngest daughter, Michael Brown was killed by a police officer. And that housing complex is just a two-minute drive away. And January has worked for most of her time as an adult. At least I went back to her work history back to 2000. And so she is technically checking off the personal responsibility boxes that President Trump and Ben Carson have said are ways to get out of the system. But at the end of the day, it's just not enough. She does make money. She does technically earn above the state's minimum wage of $7.85. But even with that, it's hard for her to make ends meet, because as soon as she got her job at a local nonprofit in St. Louis, before she got her first paycheck, her rent had increased.
So I get paid twice a month, and one of my checks goes completely to the rent. I can't buy food. I can't do anything. I get $0 worth of food stamps. I'm not receiving any child support. I work every day, so I can't go to food pantries. I mean, they make it impossible. I'm like, this is supposed to be a stepping stone. It's supposed to help families to transition to where they do not need state assistance, and there's no way to get off of this. I would literally probably have to just move.
She's essentially not able, even with her current employment, able to even get off of Section 8 housing right now, because money is just too tight.
Is the housing situation that you're describing, where there's limited housing available and long wait times for Section 8 vouchers, is that being exacerbated by gentrification at all?
I think when it comes to public housing and Section 8 housing, I'm not quite positive if it's being exacerbated by gentrification. My sense through my reporting is that the housing authorities are One, they're highly underfunded, and that is not a partisan or something unique to this administration. And two, it can be difficult to find landlords who want to accept Section 8 housing choice voucher holders because of all the stigmas that could come with that, whether that's racism or whether that's your fear that they may not care for the property. And also for the landlords, there is a long process of paperwork and inspections that goes into whether or not you choose to be a Section 8 landlord. So I think it's a lot of bureaucracy at play, the reason why it's so hard to find affordable housing.
Well, let's also talk about what the current administration's stance is when it comes to public housing. I'm thinking specifically about Ben Carson, HUD secretary, who essentially undid a 2015 rule mm-hmm. that required communities that receive HUD funding make an effort to integrate their neighborhoods. Where does that stand?
In the 1950s and the 1960s, there was a wave of white flight to the suburbs. And what you have now is a county that is mostly white, and in the city, it's pretty much predominantly Black. So there is concern that there will be more division because of the undoing of this rule, because it's no longer mandated that you make an effort to try to integrate your communities.
The president has said that the war on poverty is largely over. Does that reconcile with what you saw in St. Louis?
Yeah, not at all, actually. When I was visiting various communities, especially along the north side, people just pointing around saying, hey, look at this. Look at all these empty houses. Look at all these abandoned homes. Nobody is coming here. And people are concerned about how they're going to make ends meet. And that economic prowess and growth that Trump sees for America doesn't really reconcile with what I saw in much of the city.
Letitia Beecham is a political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Letitia, thanks for your reporting.
Oh, thank you, Tanzina, for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's been 1 year since a series of massive wildfires burned nearly a 250,000 acres in Northern California's wine country. The fires were devastating. More than 40 people lost their lives, and thousands of homes and buildings were destroyed. Vivek and Aruna Jayaraman and their two kids were among the victims. Their home burned to the ground. They lost everything and overnight became homeless. Now, 1 year later, they tell us how they survived in the weeks and months after the fires.
We were just trying so hard to figure out where we were even going to live. You know, just trying to find lodging was our utmost priority. I mean, after like going and getting the kids some underwear. But that was the most stressful part, was thinking, okay, we have to get back to work. There's only so much time you're going to be taking off. And we had no place to live. And that was really, really stressful that first week.
You know, we were fortunate for a couple of reasons. One, the community, shortly after the fires, we had friends of ours, and we didn't really know them well at the time, but they have a son at the same school as our children. And they opened up their guest house to us. And so for a period of about 5 weeks, we lived in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath guest home, but it was great. And in the sense that we had a place to stay, the kids came back to school. It's kind of a place from which we could start to orient ourselves. In parallel, about a week after the fire, we actually made an offer on a home about 10 miles from the home that we lost. You know, even to this day, you know, we just recently, about a month ago, moved for the 5th time in the last 11 months, with the hope that the next move will hopefully be the last one for quite some time. But there's still a level of dislocation, unrest that persists even 12 months after the fire.
I want to ask a question about the paperwork, just the detail, the insurance, FEMA, all of the logistical things that have to be taken care of after you found shelter. What's that been like?
It's like layering a full-time job on top of two jobs and raising a family. And so it's onerous, to say the least. You can imagine when you lose everything, literally trying to take a mental inventory of what's inside every cabinet or drawer or what might have been in every room. I mean, it's you know, you're sort of reliving on a daily basis sort of what you lost. It's been an incredibly time-consuming process.
And I'm wondering what your children have gone through. How have they, I mean, we know children are resilient, but what impact did this have on them?
You know, it was really hard for that first 5 weeks because we were living in a small space. You know, my daughter was just sleeping on the floor and I couldn't make meals. We didn't have like a routine. And that was really hard, especially on my son. You know, my daughter, I think she'd heard us say it so many times that she just kept kind of repeating, you know, all that matters is that we're safe. And for my son, it was, you know, I've lost everything. And there were things like Halloween came up, and my daughter had picked this outfit that she wanted for Halloween, and I had ordered it, and she was so excited about it. And then because it was being shipped to our old address, it just got sent back, and she didn't have it for Halloween. And you know, our school was wonderful. People donated Halloween costumes, and she picked one of those out. But that day, she was in tears. And I mean, it's something so small, right? But for her, it was a big deal. And it just made me feel so sad that one more thing was still affecting things going forward. But there were just so many things that were done for us that really made them feel like people cared. And that helped a lot, too.
What's been the emotional impact on each of you? How have you all changed in this past year?
Wow. You know, there's just been just this thing where, like, you know, you'll think about something that you've lost, like pictures. Pictures are the biggest thing. Or all the kids' art projects that I had saved over the years. And I find that I just have to block it out.
Vivek, what about you?
On some level, I feel like, okay, this is, you know, we've proven that we can survive something like this and hopefully come out of it on the other end thriving. You know, it definitely makes me appreciate the relationships that I have in my life. And at the end of the day, we have all of the really important stuff. I feel like all things considered, things are pretty good. And I anticipate they'll only get better each day going forward.
Vivek, Aruna, thanks for joining us again and telling us these stories. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
This year, there's a surge of women running for office. And within that, we're also seeing a high number of Black women running for federal office. 41 Black women are running for the House, 35 of whom are Democrats. That's the most in recent years, according to the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. These women are trying to close a big representation gap, but that heightened visibility comes with a different set of challenges. In late August, Kaya Morris, the only Black woman in Vermont's legislature, dropped out of her reelection race because of racist online threats and harassment. Black women also face extra hurdles when campaigning, like gathering funding and national endorsements. Kimberly Peeler Allen is here to talk about these issues, and she's the co-founder of Higher Heights for America, an organization working to elect Black women for public office. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
It is a pleasure to be here.
What an interesting topic this is. Let's talk a little bit about motivation, right? What I mean, we're hearing this is the year of the woman and everybody wants to run for office, but what is particularly driving women of color, more specifically Black women, to run for office?
Well, I think it is you know, this confluence of events that we find ourselves in. Black women have been running and doing the work behind the scenes for generations. You know, thinking back to like Fannie Lou Hamer and Barbara Jordan, you know, Black women have been in the trenches. And now there is this new sense of urgency. We're seeing the attempts and in many cases, the actual reality of the rollbacks of the last 50 years of progress. And we're we're seeing that, you know, Black women are saying, I can't let this happen to my community. So I'm going to step up and run. And it is that combined with the electorate realizing that, you know, over 80% of our elected officials across this country are white and male. And that is, you know, by no means represents the diversity in this nation. The electorate is saying, you know, we need to have some different voices around the table. And these Black women are speaking to my issues, regardless of, you know, the fact that they're Black, they can appeal to everybody. And it has really been a great catalyst for all of these women to run such strong primaries. And, you know, we're really looking forward to some great pickups on November 6th.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because there are some challenges specifically. And we know politics is like any other industry, right? There are challenges, as we mentioned, to funding and getting support here. Yesterday in the show, we talked about how important Black women are to the Democratic Party. They've been called the backbone of the Democratic Party. 90-some-odd% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and yet they still lack in representation in the party's leadership. One of the guests that we had raised this notion of viability of Black women candidates. And I'm wondering if you think Black women candidates are thought of by the Democratic Party as less viable because of who they are, because they can't raise the money, because they won't give them the support. What is that about?
I think that's exactly it. Higher Heights was born out of the notion that we needed a space for Black women, a political home for Black women. And Glenda Carr and I, we knew from our experience that the factors that make a Black woman a viable candidate are not necessarily the same as our white counterparts. And we know that by mobilizing our networks, because that is what we do just, you know, to make life happen for so many of us, and the volunteer effort and the word of mouth, and then also bringing our authentic selves to the campaign trail has really been a great factor in these successes. So we've always looked at candidates who walk in the spirit of Shirley Chisholm, unbought and unbossed. We look at what kind of volunteer structure they have. We look at, do they have enough money to reach their constituents? We don't need, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that so many of these races cost, but do you have the baseline of what it's going to take for you to reach your target voters? And do you have a solid campaign plan? And, you know, are you in line with issues that we believe will make sure that Black women, their communities, and their families thrive?
We should also note that 19 of the Black women who are running for the House are challenging incumbents here. Now, that could work to their favor or not, depending on what we talked about, which is funding. You know, how often is the ability to raise money part of the viability of a candidate, right? Because you mentioned you don't need hundreds and millions of dollars, but are there specific barriers to fundraising that Black women candidates face in particular?
Yeah, well, I think there is, you know, just unfortunately the institutional wealth. We haven't been here that long. We've had challenges to our communities that have not allowed us to amass the type of wealth that some of our counterparts have. The fact that Black women are making 63 cents on the dollar just, you know, from the jump. You know, we need our whole dollar if we're going to be competitive. But I think it is also thinking through, it's not just the large checks, but being able to mobilize our networks for those, you know, monthly $5 contributions that add up over time, and see those contributions as a strength, because they're not just dollars, but they're also voters and most likely volunteers.
And it's also a question of actually getting people to the polls. I mean, you can spend all the money you want. I think we saw that here in New York with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who no one thought, you know, this person was going to win, and then she wins, right? Mm-hmm. People showed up at the polls. How important is that for Black women candidates?
Absolutely. It is that is the deciding factor. We have to show up and show out at the polls to make sure that our voices are heard, make sure that we have voices around the decision-making tables that reflect our priorities.
And there's a lot of races this, and just in the midterms, we'll be watching Stacey Abrams and a bunch of other folks. Kimberly Peeler Allen is the co-founder of Higher Heights for America. Kimberly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This weekend, movie audiences will be able to take a trip to the moon.
I don't know what space exploration will uncover, but I don't think it'll be exploration just for the sake of exploration. I think it'll be more the fact that it allows us to see things that maybe we should have seen a long time ago, but just haven't been able to until now.
That's Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong in First Man, which tells the story of Apollo 11 and how Armstrong became the first person to set foot on the moon. It was a defining moment in our country's history, one that over 500 million people watched worldwide. But does the moon landing mean as much to Americans in 2018 as it did in 1969? Is it still something that unites us? I'm joined now in the studio by Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Hi, Rafer.
Hi.
And Wesley Morris, critic at large for the New York Times. Thank you for being here, Wesley.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. Well, let's talk space. What did you both think of this movie? Does it really tell the Neil Armstrong story?
I mean, it tells the story of the Apollo 11 moon landing. I mean, and the space program. And what I like about this movie is just how it's made. I think one of the problems I have with this genre of movies is basically I don't like historical movie fiction, mostly for any number of reasons, but mostly because they're all done the same, right? So there's a version of this movie that gets made that is just like, this is what it takes to get these people on the moon in 1964, 5, 6, or whatever, to 69. And here are the other missions that happened in the meantime. But Damien Chazelle is a really good filmmaker. And he has ideas. I with these movies now in 2018, like what you want to know is, why did this person want to make this movie and tell this story? And I feel like his challenge was to make the least boring looking conventional bio, you know, Hollywood historical fiction film he possibly could.
Ari, for you're nodding. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that there was a lot of good things about this movie. Amazingly directed, I think. Mm-hmm. In terms of technology, the production, the miniatures, the sets, the design, the look of the thing, the fact that it was shot on actual honest-to-God film, it looks beautiful. It's amazing. And it is one of these movies that really does put you in the capsule. I know it's a corny thing to say, but you really do feel like you're there. It's a real tooth-rattler of a movie. And it's great for that reason. You know, my objection was, Neil Armstrong just never comes to life for me in mm-hmm. this movie. You know, I think he is a very no-nonsense, get-the-job-done, man of few words, you know, very, very archetypal, kind of, you know, post-Eisenhower kind of American. And I think that made him probably a great astronaut. I think that makes him a slightly less compelling dramatic figure for a film. And I felt there was a bit of an emotional vacuum at the center of this film that sort of left me a little cold at the end.
What about, I mean, it's not like we haven't done space movies before, right? So right. I feel like there's always a space movie at some point, you know, where we're the heroes, the Americans are sort of the, you know, the main heroes here. What does that tell us about American exceptionalism? Like, when we see these movies, are we supposed to be inspired like we were by the fact that we, Americans, had made it on the moon? Is that still relevant today?
Well, you know, the one thing I thought while I was watching this was, I wouldn't do
that. That's how I felt when I watched Gravity.
You couldn't get me in that space capsule. Mostly exactly. Because what the movie actually does is show you all of the things that did go wrong with previous attempts to make this journey, and the things that are at stake. Like, even a successful version of this doesn't seem fun, right? And every time somebody goes into outer space, I'm thinking particularly about Gravity and the sort of worst case scenario that plays out in that film. I mean, there is something, and I don't know if it's inherently a matter of American exceptionalism, although, you know, part of what the space program was about was a race between us and the Russians. So this movie is aware, this movie is thoroughly aware of that. But it is also entirely aware of the sort of political incongruity of this moon landing taking place in 1969. And it cheats a little bit to get that Gil Scott-Heron song in the movie. They use Whitey's on the Moon at some point. And it's really powerful because at the exact moment, some people in the audience are like, well, I mean, I came for this, but do they know what else was going on in 1969?
Well, I was just going to say, right? 1969 wasn't exactly the most peaceful year on record. I mean, I have entire textbooks dedicated to 1969.
Sure.
You're nodding your head again, Rafer. What's that?
Well, I mean, I think the film does, like Wesley is saying, it makes this kind of late act nod toward all the other turmoil. It is a little sudden, you know. All of a sudden, you're reminded, like, oh yeah, the hippies, right? Like,
I really loved how sudden it was, though.
You like that?
I really do, because the movie is not about that. That's a whole other movie. But there, how many movies have you seen where there's just a complete divorce from what's happening in American society?
Like Apollo 13, right?
Yeah, right,
which
sure,
was right. Enough, right? That sure. I saw, and that I recall being totally divorced from that. In terms of news, we just had a pretty bad astronaut thing happened yesterday, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, there was a mission that had to be aborted. Like, is this sort of space idea really divorced from where we are with space today? Does it mean the same thing as it meant to kids, you know, who were growing up back in the 60s and 70s?
I think this might go to the controversy about Chazelle not showing the planting of the American flag. He does show the American flag planted. We see it there on the moon's surface. But he does not show us Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong planting the flag. And Chazelle has said that that was just a choice. What he wanted to focus on were the private moments of Neil Armstrong and not the well-known public moments that we've all seen a million times. But I wonder if maybe Chazelle, at the age of, I think he's 33, is so young that maybe this idea of the American flag being planted just seems like a very kind of corny, very old-fashioned, and possibly a little colonialist of an idea. It was a pretty old-fashioned idea in 1969. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the idea that we were going to go up to some, there was no place left to go, but we found it, the moon, and we went out there and we stuck a flag in it. Even then, that seemed like an idea from a few hundred years ago.
Sort of our manifest destiny.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder if to someone of Chazelle's generation, that maybe that just doesn't give him that same kind of fluttery feel, that maybe it's got more negative connotations, even if that's just subconscious.
I also think that that's just not the movie he made. I mean, there's a case to be made for this same movie, Planting the Flag, if it's explicitly a movie about racing the Russians to the moon or racing the Russians to outer space. But again, to the question of like whether the Neil Armstrong story matters in 2018, I watched this. I went into this movie skeptical of the entire enterprise because my first thought was Damien Chazelle, very exciting young filmmaker. Why the hell is he making a movie about this? But he can do whatever he wants. He's an artist. I respect that. The other thing I thought was, you're going to call it First Man? Do you know what's going on in this country right now? First Man? But it's a movie about Neil Armstrong. What else are you going to call it? But I mean, I tended to think about all that stuff simultaneously as real, genuine human curiosity about this larger existence way, way beyond us. And I also thought about Whitey's on the moon, you know? And, you know, I watched this movie in both states, and to have the movie sort of meet me where half my brain was actually, I got a little chill from that because the movie really didn't have to acknowledge what else was happening in this country at that point.
On that note, Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Wesley Morris is critic at large for The New York Times. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks
for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.